summary of the chapter Atonement and Eucharist from the standpoint of the capitalized synonymous terms for God which permeate this chapter. Gordon Brown, London, June 1970.
Well now, when we got to the end of the first chapter in this study of the textbook, that is the prayer chapter, we tried to let what we had learnt regarding the capitalized terms for God in this chapter sum up for us the essence of the subject prayer, didn't we? And now that we've come to the close of the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, let's try this afternoon to see if we can do exactly the same thing with this chapter. And the only thing is, as you observe, the second chapter is over twice the length of the first. It's got 37 pages, whereas the first chapter has only, 17 pages. And that really makes it quite an undertaking. But however, let's see how we go. Now, what is our attitude to such a task? Do we think of ourselves as being a little group of human beings collecting together and setting out to think consecratedly about this subject of atonement and Eucharist? Or, on the other hand, is atonement and Eucharist, all that that means, is that really an idea, an eternal idea in the bosom of the divine principle, and therefore is not this principle, this divine principle love, expressing itself, revealing itself, stating itself in terms of this idea, atonement and Eucharist, as us, here and now? See, this must be our attitude if we're going to achieve anything in following the text through from beginning to end, isn't it so? Extraordinarily enough, it wasn't until 1902 that the final order of the chapters in the textbook arrived. And then this remarkable chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, took its place as the second chapter of the book. See, really, the first chapter is our great prayer, the opening of our thought, the reaching forward to what Atonement and Eucharist really means, stands for, teaches, and so on. And what does it really teach us? In just one word, isn't it really the way? You know how often and often and often through the text we have found references to the way. This is what the chapter is about. It's the way. The way whereby the individual, individuality, understood spiritually, understood scientifically, the way in which individuality solves from beginning to end the whole life problem. Now, as such, this chapter forms a great foundation for us as we reach it and as we encompass it. It's the story of how the individual has solved, how individuality has, in fact, solved the problem of being from beginning to end, and therefore how individuality solves this problem. And therefore, from the point of the third chapter onwards, the marriage chapter, all the way through to the end of the book, the 16th chapter, Apocalypse, it is this standpoint of atonement and Eucharist being put into practice, being put into expression, until every one of us has solved identically the same universal problem, solved it individually, this same universal problem as Jesus solved it. Just think for a moment, we know, don't we, how that third chapter marriage opens. It's based on the statement, isn't it? What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Well, what God has joined together can't possibly be, can it, the male and female of mortality, which is what religiously minded mortals would like to think. Rather, is it what we learn about in Atonement and Eucharist, the forces, the factors, the elements that we learn about in Atonement and Eucharist, this is it, these are it that God has joined together. Joined together is, of course, God and man, principle and its idea, the manhood and womanhood of God, what Paul would call the head and the body of the Son of God. What God has joined together is really the individual in perfect harmonious relationship to his entire universe. And this is what Jesus is demonstrating in this second chapter. And this is it that goes into expression from the third chapter onwards until we reach the close of the Apocalypse. Because we remember how that Apocalypse chapter closes, don't we? How does it go? The male and female as no longer two wedded individuals, but as two individual natures in one. And this compounded spiritual individuality reflects God as Father, Mother, not as a corporeal being. Now you see, we are right back, therefore, at the point of Atonement and Eucharist. It hasn't been a straight line. The journey isn't a straight line. It has circled all the way back from marriage to the Apocalypse. We have circled back to the point from which we started. That is, from Atonement and Eucharist. Because that is the very essence of Atonement and Eucharist, and only that, clearly, is going to solve the problem in the way that Jesus solved it. See, then it is that at the close of Atonement and Eucharist, divine love is my shepherd, I shall not want. How can I want what I am? The point has been reached when I am, when it can be said I am what I am. And how then can I want? And the problem is solved. Because you see, then that wonderful statement at the beginning, on the very second page of the preface, where you get this statement of the mighty healing truth, truth with a capital T there, seen as a divine system of ideas, which is Christian Science. It is said of that system that it is full, has been fully tested and not been found wanting. And by the time your and my thought has ranged from marriage through to the close of apocalypse, it will certainly have been fully tested and not be found wanting. Now this is atonement and Eucharist. This is the great principle that is elucidated in atonement and Eucharist. The principle of the at-one-ment of all things with all things. The total universe at one with itself, within itself. In modern terminology, the great cybernetic, divinely cybernetic universe. So shall we open the book then at page 18, which is the beginning of this second chapter? I don't think there's any doubt, is there, but that the key to it lies in these two opening marginal headings of the first two paragraphs. Do you think? Divine oneness and human reconciliation. The great fact is divine oneness, bringing into expression human reconciliation so that the human and the divine are found to be one, one and indivisible, and this is the great at-one-ment. The whole proposition of atonement for sin is taken care of within this conception of the at-one-ment of the human and the divine. That's clear, isn't it? Atonement, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's from, obviously, the word atone, which is from at one, to cause to be at one. And the meaning of at one is to be or bring to a state of agreement, reconciliation, to restore to friendly relations, to join in one, to form by uniting. And the word Eucharist means fundamentally a giving of thanks. Well, what is that? That is where we are accepting, where we are understanding this at-one-ment, where we are eating it up, assimilating it, understanding it, and therefore being it, where we are making it our own. So that the whole idea here is that of being what we are, namely the undivided, the deathless Christ body. Being what we are. This is the beginning and the end of the whole thing, isn't it? So, as we open the book at the beginning of, open the chapter at the beginning there, let's just read a couple of the opening sentences. And it goes like this, that atonement, is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love. Jesus of Nazareth taught and demonstrated man's oneness with the Father, and for this we owe him endless homage. His mission was both individual and collective. His mission was both individual and collective. Now, I don't know if you've examined the meaning of this word exemplification. I didn't do so until yesterday afternoon. And here we are, we've been all the way through this chapter, and it has spoken to us, and it has said things to us. And when I thought, I will just examine what that word means, and I could scarcely believe my eyes that it was so utterly confirmatory of the sort of feeling, the spirit of this chapter that has come to us as we have pursued it. Exemplification, obviously it's from the same root as example. And this word example is the same in meaning as the word ensample. You know, sometimes Zeddy actually uses the word ensample instead of example relative to Jesus. And of course the word ensample is the same as sample. And what is a sample? A sample is where a part of something shows forth the quality of the whole of that something, which is exactly what we've been feeling, you see. And an example is a pattern to be followed. An example is defined like this: it's one or a portion taken to show the character or quality of all. See, this is what the chapter is about. Because here, in this teaching, and as shown forth by Jesus, the individual is a sample of the whole, in the true meaning of the word sample, ensample, example. A sample of the whole. And except he is a sample of the whole, he's not an individual. Individuality is just a personal sense, based on personal sense, except it is a sample of the whole. And so this atonement, this at-one-ment, man's unity with God, which is man reflecting, and now we get this first statement of capitalized terms. It is summed up, as it were, in man reflecting divine truth, life, and love. This particular combination of these three terms that recurs four times throughout the course of the chapter. The chapter as a whole teems with references to truth and love. It is dominated by what is meant by the two terms truth and love, used either singly or used in combination. 12 times we get the combination truth and love, literally dominating the chapter. And interestingly enough, it is only when we finally reach the Apocalypse, the 16th chapter, that again this combination, these two terms, truth and love, singly and in combination, dominate once more. which seems to imply that thought has, as it were, circled right back to this foundational standpoint and principle elucidated in the second chapter. Truth, life, and love. Truth and love joined, jointed together by life, joined in life. Truth and love in their undividedness, in their absolute unity, that really is what life is. And so man's unity with God is man reflecting divine truth, life, and love. We find with this combination, truth, life, and love, that every time it is used, it seems to be used to show this sense of unity, to define this sense of absolute unity of man and God. The individual with his universe, in perfect relationship with his total universe, only when that is experienced and demonstrated can it be said that the human problem is solved. That is Jesus at the point of the ascension. This absolute harmonious jointing or wedlock with his total universe. And the terms that seem to be needed to express that is this combination truth, life, and love. Do you remember at the close, you see, here is the chapter opening on this note, but what about the first chapter? It wasn't until we really got nearly to the end of it and thought entered, do you remember the sanctuary where it had audience, where it was in communion with principle, that the door was said to open and in came truth, life, and love. It's the same combination of terms used in both instances. See, there at the close of prayer, which is called the prayer of soul, isn't it? There man is praying. The prayer goes up, our Father, Mother, God. And the range of terms that seems to express, to impel that prayer, if you like, this state of consciousness, our Father, Mother, God, is the three terms, truth, life, and love. Our Father, Mother, God, all harmonious. The great harmonious jointing of all things to all things within and constituting the one thing. Our Father, Mother, God. And here it is opening on that note. So, obviously, clearly, his mission was both individual and collective. I'd just like to note on line 10 there, how Jesus acted boldly against the accredited evidence of the senses. Don't you think that that really sums up the teaching of the chapter? Was there ever such an instance of the individual acting boldly, acting against the accredited evidence of the senses? It's refuting the evidence of the senses. When these three terms, truth, life, and love, are really understood, when we become conscious of what they mean, by golly, the accredited evidence of the senses is certainly refuted. Now, as we blend from that opening paragraph into the second paragraph, and you see it teeming with these terms, it's a very delicate one can't say involved, but profound statement, isn't it? I wonder if we could just simply summarize the meaning, something like this. You see, in that second paragraph, there are really three factors involved that are standing out. One, there is God, who is defined as principle, as love, where all law resides. The law of love, which is, we are told, is the same as the law of spirit. That's the first thing. Secondly, there is Christ, which is defined as truth. And thirdly, there is man. And our great need is to understand the absolute unity of those three: God, Christ, man. And it is man, through Christ, through what is meant by the term Christ or truth, finding this unity with the divine principle, which is love. And when that happens, that's spirit. And the law of spirit is in operation, maintaining that unity. So that the term Christ is acting here as a sort of mediator wherein and whereby you and I find ourselves in and of this total at-one-ment of all being. Through this Christ truth. Now all this great idea of the at-one-ment of everything with everything is the whole truth that on page 19, line 12, Jesus spoke. The whole truth, with a little t there. It's the wholeness of truth that we see with Jesus, spelt with a capital T, voicing itself as this whole truth. Humanly, so that the human finds itself in and of, inseparable from, finds itself to be the very expression of the divine. This whole truth seems to set households at variance and do a lot of breaking up, and it seems to act like a sword instead of peace, but it's only a question of this whole truth on the one hand, and the apparent breakup of everything as the antithesis of truth on the other. There is no truth in the fragmentary breakup sense of life that we seem to experience as mortals. Truth lies in this total wholeness or at-one-ment. That, and in this instance, is signified simply by the term truth. That's where truth lies. That's truth. So as we come down that page to line 25, we see that this is the principle. This is the principle with which we are concerned. This principle of the wholeness of everything as signified by the term truth. And the need is to demonstrate this principle in order to have part in God. See there on line 26. Those who cannot demonstrate on line 25, at least in part, this divine principle, have no part in God. Go back to line 21. The need is to have part in the at-one-ment with God. See that? And as this at-one-ment is realized, or appears, if you like, sin disappears. Atonement, at-one-ment, eliminates sin because sin is the opposite of at-one-ment. Sin is the apparent breakup of everything, and therefore the answer to sin is the at-one-ment of everything with everything else. Now, when this, in the measure that this takes place in our thinking, in our consciousness, this is doing the will of wisdom on line 24. Doing the will of wisdom. What it means is that the part, when it is a true part, can have no will of its own. The will of the part is the will of the whole. And this is you and me in relation to our universe. The will of the individual is the will of the indivisible wholeness of everything. Then that's the principle in expression. And we begin to find this amplified, borne out for us as we come to the bottom of page 19, and we see, oh yes, well now, then it's a matter of one God and not a lot of gods. No other gods before me. One God instead of gods. One life instead of a lot of independent lives. And over the page, that becomes one spirit instead of a lot of spirits. The principle of at-one-ment begins to be stated then. Thou shalt not know evil, for there is one life. There is no evil in this one life, when life is one and indivisible. There is only evil when, in belief, this one life is broken up into a lot of lives, or this one God is broken up into a lot of gods, or the one truth is broken up, and we seem to get a part departing from the whole. That's error. And that's sin. So Jesus' whole endeavor is to prove the nothingness of this departure of a part from the whole, which would mean a part having a will of its own, an independent ego of its own, instead of having the will of the whole, the will of the whole being the will of the part, the individual in relation to his universe. Caesar and God, rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, is seeing this proposition of the apparent parting up of everything. Rendering to God the things that are God's is the idea of the wholeness of everything. Caesar's things are separated parts. God's things are all parts united indissolubly in one whole. And the need is to distinguish between the one and the other, and the term spirit there is used there in order to distinguish between the one and the other. Now, as we come down this page 20 to line 19 to our next capitalized term, which is the term truth, here we see the power of truth, because it is only in this wholeness that power lies. There's no power in the breakup of the whole into segregated parts. And therefore, this whole truth rejects the error of segregated parts, whereas the segregated parts, which is the concept of men on line 16, would seem to reject this idea of the wholeness of truth, where we all find ourselves whole together in one whole truth. Now, within the divine order of everything that inheres within this one whole truth, we see Jesus operating, obeying this divine order. And by reason of this divine order of the wholeness of everything in truth, traversing the path from sin to holiness. Because sin is progressively eliminated as this idea of the wholeness of everything grows and grows with us. On line 25, the truth, that is, the whole truth with a little t, is the center of all true religion, that is to say. It commands sure entrance into the realm of love with a capital L, and as soon as the capitalized terms come in, you know that you are touching science. Not exactly in contrast to religion, and yet you must distinguish between science and religion, because once you touch science, that includes, of course, true religion within itself. So this idea of the wholeness of truth with a little t commands sure entrance into the realm of science. And therefore, as we come down to the bottom of that page, we see that what we are in fact doing is laying aside material sense and self, that is the fragmentary sense of having a self apart from the whole, and seeking the divine principle and science of all healing. The divine principle and science of that which makes whole, because it is whole. Therefore it makes whole. It heals. Now, if this truth, this whole truth on the top of 21, is overcoming the error of fragmentation in our daily walk and conversation, then, of course, it's a question of being a better and a better man. And the sentence comes, therefore, on line 5, this is having our part in the at-one-ment with truth and love. Here comes the combination for the first time in the chapter of truth and love. Having our part, this, I think, is the key sentence, possibly, can't really say in the chapter, but it is such a key sentence, isn't it? Having what is meant by having our part in the at-one-ment with truth and love. The opposite of being separated up into bits and pieces, the at-one-ment within the wholeness of truth, and that wholeness held and grasped and embraced and maintained in its wholeness by love. If love wasn't operating here with us at the moment, we'd all break apart. It's only love that's keeping us together here at this moment. And our togetherness is in truth, but it's love that's holding us together. Without love, we'd all break apart. And this wonderful, wonderful combination truth and love is so dominant throughout this chapter. So that based on this principle at the bottom of page 20, operating in this science, the disciple is advancing spiritually. He's turning away from the material sense of everything being broke up into bits and pieces and is looking towards the imperishable spirit, because this is what spirit is. This is imperishable spirit, this wholeness of truth, this unity of truth and love, where everyone has part in the at-one-ment with truth and love. This is spirit. And so, we're journeying together. Line 16. We're not having separate timetables, different routes. We're not having divergent paths. Opportunity to help each other, but with every opportunity to help each other. Our mutual interests are identical, and we have, on line 25, companionship. By reason of this at-one-ment, having part in the at-one-ment with truth and love, that's what's determining it. So, as we follow the course of the 7 days of creation indicated on line 30 at the bottom of 21, we are moving forward together. And it's the very opposite on 22 of this selfishness and sensuality, which is this belief of being segregated, separated parts, the opposite of all that. And this is Christ. Now we come to our next term on line 60. This is what is meant by the term Christ. Christ, the undivided, the not divided. This is Christ's demands. Mortals seem to experience suffering because they seem to be all broken up and separated. And they make vigorous efforts to help themselves. And it is through Christ's precious love, because this is really love. This idea of the wholeness of everything put into expression is really love. It's Christ's precious love, and it crowns these efforts with success. And we see the demand, the Christ demand, that causes this awakening to take place, waking to Christ's demand. This Christ demand is the demand of life and love, saying, work out your own individual salvation. This is life and love speaking, the life which is love speaking, demanding. Work out your own, that implies individual salvation. It's having part in the at-one-ment. That occupy till I come, you know, is from the parable of the talents. And it's use your talent. What is your talent? Your one talent. It's individuality. That's the talent. Be individual. But be individual spiritually, which means be individual universally. This is life and love demanding that individuality is universal and not an egocentric subdivision of life, which is what mortals think individuality is. Now we come down onto line 20, sorry. And love. Love this so demands this that it isn't hasty to deliver us from the temptation to be segregated, separated bogus individuals. No, no. Because love means that we shall be tried and purified of all that. And we shall find our part in the at-one-ment with truth and love. This is what love means. And as we come up to page 23, it is, of course, wisdom and love that is at work. This is wisdom, and this is love, requiring many sacrifices of that false sense of self to save us from the sin of separation and segregation and egotism and all the rest of it. The atonement on line 4 requires constant self-immolation on the sinner's part. He must not be a part, departed from the whole. That's being a sinner. He must find his part, himself part of the at-one-ment with truth and love. So the atonement requires constant self-immolation on the sinner's part. And on line 10, truth. Now, truth again. Truth destroys this suffering, error of sinful sense. Suffering, error, sinful sense. It's all to do with this belief of being broken apart from the whole. But truth destroys it because in truth, with a capital T, no such thing has ever taken place. Truth is the wholeness. And therefore sin, which is suffering, which is this separation sense, falls at the feet of everlasting love. Line 19 to the term spirit again. Because this is spirit. This is spirit. What it amounts to is the consciousness of spiritual understanding. Here is spiritual understanding, holding us all together within the wholeness of truth, the oneness of love. And that is spirit evidencing itself, rebuking sin of every kind, and establishing the claims of God. Now, as spirit, as we see now what is meant by the term spirit, and that this is in fact spirit at work, establishing this state of spiritual understanding, it includes this wonderful trustfulness, not only being trustful, but being trustworthy at the same time. Understanding divine love, how to work out one's own individual salvation, involving self-reliant trustworthiness, which includes spiritual understanding and trusts all to God, confides all to the oneness of being, to the one infinite all-inclusive being, trusting all, giving all back to the one, turning from this broken up sense of life, which is the death proposition Jesus must eliminate, and giving it all back, and then find that it's a thing of life. Well, this indeed is being firm. This indeed is being constant, and it's truth and love again that is at work. The firmness of everything lies in the wholeness of truth. The constancy of everything lies in that love which constantly holds everything whole in truth. It's what the Bible is all about, this. In its original form, the original meaning of the Bible, this is it. And as we touch, therefore, the original meaning of the Bible in this way, the way is open for Christian Science to be understood. And the Bible becomes to us the chart of life. From Genesis to Revelation, it's the chart of life, where we see the teaching of this wholeness of truth, which becomes to us not only that where we can moor ourselves and fix ourselves and find safety, but also wherein we flow together, the healing currents of truth. It's what the Bible is teaching all the way through this. And as such, this teaching is the very arm of the Lord. It's causing us to humanly to rise into newness of life, to be reborn with regeneration. And now it comes again on line 13, 24, 13, that this is having part in the at-one-ment, in the atonement. It's all a matter of having part, a sample that partakes of the nature of the whole, but is never taken out of the whole, always remains in and of the whole. So this is having part, and having part is the understanding in which Jesus suffered and triumphed. We come down to the bottom of 24, the last paragraph there, and we see how this is being demonstrated. Jesus is demonstrating this on behalf of mankind as a whole. The truth, little t, had been lived among men. The truth of what we're talking about had been lived among men. It's this wholeness of truth that enables us to triumph over the grave. Do we see that? Why it is that this wholeness that obtains in truth enables us to triumph over the grave? That is, for there to be resurrection, line 32, and this resurrection is the complete and utter proof, the total proof of truth and love. So we're back with the combination truth and love again. When we see this rising into newness of life, this regeneration, this resurrection, that is the work not of Jesus, but of truth and love. It's the great, final, total proof of truth and love. That everything everywhere is whole, jointed with everything else in truth, and held as such within the embrace of love. What appears to the senses as the resurrection is simply the total proof of this fact, or this fact proving itself. And this, of course, is life. 25:10. His true flesh and blood were his life. and they truly eat his flesh and drink his blood, who partake of that divine life, which is truth and love, who partake of the life, which is the absolute unity of truth and love. This unity of truth and love, which is life, is the way. It is the way of life and its principle. This is principle. And therefore this way of life, because its principle can be understood and can be demonstrated because its principle. And on line 19, it is the principle of being, with a little b. It's the principle of the true human being, the divine principle of the true human being. If you love it, of course, you'll keep the commandments of this principle. And so, to emphasize that it is principle, we come down 25, 26. Understanding this divine principle, demonstrating this power. There isn't any power but in the oneness, in the wholeness. Immediately the whole is in belief broken up into bits and separated parts. Power is dissipated, expended. Power lies only, therefore, in the principle of this unity of truth and love, which is life. Death is loss of power, but life, the principle which is truth and love, the unity of everything, therein lies power. And so this is Christ. This is what Christ is, and it's divine. And the divinity of the Christ has manifestation, and its manifestation is humanity. Made manifest in the humanity of Jesus. The divine and the human, one. This is the at-one-ment. 26:8. This is the demonstration of his love, with a little l. Till all are redeemed through divine love, with a big l. Love with a little l, the human, the true human, the manifestation of love with a big L, the divine. The divinity of love with a big L is made manifest in the humanity of love with a little L. And the two are one. So that this Christ, which is spirit, is the way. Humanly. It's the truth, little t, and the life, little l. And we find that, therefore, I and my Father are one. It's the divinity of the human. It's the divinity of the man, Jesus. It's your and my divinity. It's your and my divine nature, humanly. It's the godliness which animates us, here and now. Now, in order to sum it up, to see what is at work, as it were doing this, the need is for the three terms on 26:14, truth, life, and love. This is what is at work. The wholeness of truth, which is the deathlessness of life, which is the all-inclusiveness of love, this is it which has authority over sin, sickness and death, and this is it which reveals science. The science of being, the science of humanity's true being, which is celestial, heavenly. Humanity's true being is celestial. And all this is the science of it. The science which reveals what God is, divinely, what he does for man, humanly, so that the two are one. This is the at-one-ment, and what the chapter is all about. It's the way being learnt by practice as well as precept, line 21. It's the marvelous music that obtains within truth with a capital T, where we are all jointed, related, wedded with each other, the parts inseparable from each other and therefore from the whole. And the practice of this truth with a capital T involves such a sacrifice of the segregated sense of being apart that we have to admit its principle to be love. The sacrifice on the part of the egotistical sense of the mortal is such, in this practice of truth with a capital T, that its principle couldn't possibly be other than love.